This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. For many of us, as soon as cooler weather returns, so too does the desire to fill the home with the aroma of cookies and breads just out of the oven. Whether you're adventurous and ready to try something new, or the dog-eared recipe of an old favorite is hauled out of the drawer, this hour we ask, can that recipe be made even better? The chocolate chip cookie a little chewier or softer, the old favorite even more flavorful. There's a science to baking, and so we're going to explore ingredients and how they react together along with temperature and time. And along the way, we'll get some insight as to how to hopefully make the perfect chocolate chip cookie. If you'd like to get into the conversation, 888-477-9499 is the number to call, or you can send us an email to radiotimes@whyy.org. Peter Scarola is pastry chef at R2L in Center City. He led a chocolate chip cookie lab experiment at the Philadelphia Science Festival last year. Hi, Peter. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hello, Mary. Thanks for having me.
And Rosemary Trout is head of Culinary Arts and Food Science Hospitality Management at Drexel University, and she teaches undergraduate food science. Welcome, Rosemary.
Thanks so much. It's nice to be here.
Nice to have you both here. So, Peter, let's begin with your lab experiment at the Science Festival. You worked with, I read, nine different groups,
yes.
And you gave each a slightly altered version of Nestle's Toll House cookie recipe. So what was the goal here, first
Correct.
Of all?
Well, the goal was to create a lab environment and test chocolate chip cookies. Everybody loves chocolate chip cookies and loves baking. So I made the controlled recipe, the standard Toll House chocolate chip cookie, and the other groups had a slight alteration. For example, one group used all baking powder in their recipe instead of baking soda. One group used all white sugar instead of the combination of brown sugar and white sugar. One group used bread flour. One group used gluten-free flour. One group used melted butter instead of the soft butter. And yes.
Yeah, and we'll talk about the results of the experiment as we get a little further into the show. But right. First, let's talk about the switches that were made. And Rose will talk about sugar to start with. Toll House cookies,
yes.
They have that mix of brown sugar and white. And so in the recipes that use all white sugar,
mm-hmm.
what happens in a cookie that doesn't have that mix?
Well, white sugar is different from brown sugar in that brown sugar has some molasses still attached to the crystals. That makes a big difference. When you use brown sugar, number one, you can see very clearly that the color is different. So right off the bat, you know that you might be expecting a darker cookie with a darker sugar. And that does happen, in fact. With the molasses attached to the sugar crystals, molasses is what we call an invert sugar, and it's liquid at room temperature. It holds on to moisture really nicely, and so you end up with a chewy cookie, a nice dark cookie as well.
And is that what you found, Peter?
I did.
Chewier, darker cookie,
yes.
with the traditional, as opposed to what did you find with the cookie
Correct.
That was just
so,
all the white sugar?
With all the white sugar, the cookie became flat as it baked. So another component in brown sugar, it contains acid.
Mm-hmm.
And the acid is in the recipe to react with baking soda. So if you have a recipe with baking soda and without acid, the baking soda doesn't react. So the cookie won't leaven properly.
So it won't rise as much.
Correct.
You'll have a flatter cookie.
Correct,
mm-hmm.
correct. And the flavor is much different. The brown sugar creates kind of a butterscotch flavor.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it creates some moisture inside the cookie as well.
So when in the cookie that had just simply white sugar, was it a sweeter cookie?
It was a sweeter cookie and a little crispier mm-hmm. around the
mm-hmm.
edges.
So it was a little flatter because
flatter.
It didn't rise as much.
Correct, correct.
Right. And again, this all depends on what you want in a cookie. So if somebody wants a flatter cookie, maybe they'd opt for just, you know, straight white sugar as opposed to mixing.
Right.
Exactly.
Let's talk about, before we move on to flours, for those who are looking to cut back on sugar content, are there some natural flavorings which work as well, Rose? Juices, that sort of thing?
This is a tough one. When you add, right, Peter? When you add liquids to cookies, they spread a little bit more. And then we're also having an interplay in the type of flour that you're using. When you add liquids like juices and things like this, your sugars are going to dissolve and you'll get a different kind of profile. But a low sugar cookie is a tough thing to come up with.
A good low sugar.
A good low, yes. Good clarification point, right. Yes.
Peter, you have any thoughts?
I would suggest
this?
Eating less of the cookie.
Okay. You don't want to compromise the flavor and the texture. Correct. All right. So let's get into the different flours. I use a bread flour for a cinnamon bread that I make because that's what the recipe calls for. But what would happen if I used a standard flour? I use generally just the unbleached white flour.
I think flour, all-purpose flour for home cooking is a good flour to use in general. When we're talking about flour and the difference between, say, bread flour or all-purpose or cake or pastry flour, it's all about the protein content. So bread flour has a higher protein content than does all-purpose, and it has quite a bit more than you would find in a pastry or a cake flour. So the more protein you have, the more gluten development. You've maybe are familiar with gluten a little bit, mm-hmm. and so that gives structure that you want in some baked products like breads. And it when you don't want a whole lot of structure, as in a cookie or some cakes, then you want a lower protein flour. It also then affects the amount of moisture that you add. When you have a higher protein flour, you usually need more liquid because the proteins soak up the liquid very nicely.
So then if you're using a bread flour as opposed to a regular flour, you're going to have a higher baked good. It's going to rise.
We'll have more structure.
Structure.
Right,
it'll be a little bit firmer, a sturdier
bread or dough.
Or cookie,
correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Peter Scroll, I believe you said that in your cookie experiment, there was one group got, was it gluten-free?
Gluten-free flour, yes.
So what did you find happened with that cookie?
Well, the cookie spread a bit more because it didn't have that gluten structure to hold the leavening inside the cookie. And it was actually a pretty tasty cookie.
So it worked.
It worked. It was a fine substitute. And then with the bread flour recipe, interestingly enough, there wasn't a huge difference. When you mix a cookie dough, a chocolate chip cookie dough, when you add the flour, there's not much mixing after you add the flour. Yeah. Okay, you're going to add the flour with the leavener, which will be baking soda, and then the chocolate chips. And in order to really develop the gluten in a dough, if you were going to make a bread dough, you need to knead the dough. Mm. And without the kneading, it doesn't really develop a ton of gluten structure inside the dough. So the cookie itself was pretty comparable to an all-purpose flour cookie.
And just to clarify, when you switched out ingredients in your experiment among these nine groups, it was just one ingredient per group, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
So, go ahead, Rose.
I just wanted to add that with cookies, we are talking about baked goods that have very little added moisture to them.
Yeah.
And in order for you to get good gluten development, you need water in order for that complex to form.
Okay. Well, so then let's get to breads because there are so many people who are concerned about gluten. Mm-hmm. For somebody who can't tolerate gluten, there is gluten-free flour. Does that work as well when you're trying to bake a bread? And if not, because of the structure issue, what can you add to the mix to help make a decent loaf of bread for somebody who can't tolerate gluten?
Bread is the difficult side of being gluten-free. So because when you make gluten, and gluten is a combination of two different proteins that are naturally occurring in wheat, and so when you have these two proteins, it's called gliadin and glutenin, when you add water and knead those together, you get this fantastic network that traps in carbon dioxide that's produced by yeast in order to get this really nice structure in bread. When we're talking about cookies or other types of desserts, they don't rely on that structure so much. So I think you get better results with gluten-free flours, which are a mixture of non-wheat flours, in essence, for shortened types of pastries, cakes, cookies, than you do for bread. I think bread's a really tough one to figure out gluten-free.
Peter?
It is. I agree. Bread, I don't have much experience baking gluten-free bread. At the restaurant, we do make a gluten-free biscuit that we offer to our gluten-free guests for our bread service.
So there is a demand for it.
So there's definitely a demand for it. Every night we have several guests that request gluten-free products and a gluten-free menu. So we do try and accommodate those guests. And I found personally the best way is with biscuits. It's a dough where you're not kneading it. You're not developing the gluten to create this baked good. Mm-hmm. So a gluten-free flour works really well with that.
Let's get to kneading for just a moment. Can you overwork a dough so it becomes tough? And what happens there if that's the case?
You certainly can overwork a dough. I think for home cooks, it's kind of hard to do that. It takes a whole lot of energy. And it depends on what your end result. If you're making bread, you need to knead it quite a bit. If you're making a pie crust, you don't want any kneading at all. And so somewhere along that continuum, you get the right balance. You can overknead. If you're using a dough hook or if you're in more of an industrial or commercial kind of kitchen, I think that can happen. Your gluten stretches, it breaks, and then it's not going to trap the carbon dioxide that's mm-hmm. produced in order to give you these nice air pockets.
Any thoughts on the proper amount of kneading?
Well, again, it depends on what you're baking. Yeah. With a cookie and a pastry, you don't want to do a lot of kneading. You definitely don't want to develop too much gluten in a cookie dough. So once your dry ingredients are incorporated into the dough, that's it. You turn your mixer off, you stop mixing it. Don't mess with it, because the more you work it, the more gluten you develop, the tougher your cookie will be.
It's really all about developing a touch, too, isn't it? If you work enough in the kitchen, you really know, after a while, how long and how much, and you develop a sense for it. So.
Yes.
I think one of the things that people maybe overlook sometimes is also the value of resting certain doughs when you're dealing with gluten. You want your proteins to be completely hydrated so that the water and the gluten proteins form this nice complex. And so resting a dough, this is a little bit off the topic, but when you're making pasta, for instance, is really, really important. You can definitely feel a difference when you quickly mix a dough, even if it's a kneaded dough, and you don't rest the dough. One is the rested dough is more resilient. It's easier to work with than a tight dough that hasn't rested.
Correct.
All right. Oh, and I do want to say before we get to the break, Rosemary baked us a lovely plate full of chocolate chip cookies. And I did want to ask you, Rosemary, what sort of bread did you bread flour, not bread.
Flour.
So is it standard flour?
All-purpose, unbleached flour.
Okay. Shortening?
The shortening was all butter. Who doesn't love butter?
We're going to talk about butter after the break
and how
we use butter and substitutes for everybody. Yeah, not everybody, of course, can use it.
Okay.
And the sugar. This looks like a cookie that's got some brown in it.
It does. Blend. I did, yes.
Okay. So we're talking this hour about the science of baking. And along the way, we were also talking about baking, hopefully, the perfect chocolate chip cookie. And if you've got any questions or comments, the lines are open at 888-477-9499. Also, you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We've got some folks who've already up on the board, so we'll get to them after the break. We are joined by Peter Scarola, pastry chef at R2L, and Rosemary Trout, who is head of culinary arts and food science at Drexel University. Stay with us. There's more just ahead. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, along with Peter Scarola. He is pastry chef at R2L, and Rosemary Trout is head of culinary arts and food science, hospitality management at Drexel University. We are talking about the science of baking and how to work in the kitchen so that you can perhaps tweak those favorite recipes so they can be even better. And just before we move on to butter and other fats, I have a question from our engineer, Kevin Griffin, who bakes and cooks beautifully, but he wanted to know the difference between bleached and unbleached flour and whether this makes a difference when you are putting together, hopefully, the perfect cookie.
I think it makes a bigger difference when you're baking bread than when mm-hmm. you're baking cookies. I use unbleached flour almost exclusively at my home. With bleaching of flour, the reason it's bleached is because there are certain pigments that naturally occur in the wheat, and they give kind of a golden color to the wheat. They also add some nutritive value to the wheat, so there's something to be said for leaving them there and not bleaching them. Sure. People through history have gone from whole grain, stone ground, through commodity wheat that is industrially produced. And so bleaching made the flour white. It also, to some degree, can strengthen the gluten when we're talking about bread. As far as unbleached flour with cookies, I don't know that there's a big substantial difference with using either bleached or unbleached. But like I said, my experience is mostly with unbleached flour.
So, Rose, with bleached flour, you said it strengthens?
It can strengthen the gluten.
This is the bread, which means what if you're working with a loaf of bread, if you're kneading it, et cetera, you have to keep in mind what if you're using bleached
flour. It kind of stabilizes the gluten formation in the bread.
So a little less kneading, though, so it doesn't get tough?
I suppose you could say that. In general, though, I think commodity flour has traditionally been aged and bleached. They used to, in the wheat industry, the bread industry, used to add chemical bleaching agents. People are more food savvy these days, and they don't necessarily want all those additional chemicals, synthetic chemicals added to their food supply. So I think that we see lots of stone ground wheat, whole wheat coming back into play. If you were to mill wheat and immediately bake with it, you would notice if you were making bread that the gluten may not have quite as much structure. Mm. Would it be more delicious? I happen to think so. And probably more we'd probably get more nutritional quality out of that bread as well.
Peter Scarola, what do you use at R2L?
Unbleached flour. The only exception, I believe, is with cake flour. We use it for certain cakes, very light, spongy cakes, and I'm not 100% certain, but I believe all cake flour is bleached, and that helps to create the lightness and airiness in the flour.
And so if you wanted a light, airy cookie, would you then perhaps go to the cake flour?
You could substitute cake flour, yes.
Okay,
yes.
Just to try.
Right.
All right, so when you bake, Peter, do you favor butter? Rose said before the break she uses butter. I have to say during the holidays, I love butter. Mm-hmm. I love to use butter. But not everybody, you know, for health reasons, can handle a lot of butter, if any. So so tell us about the use of butter in cookies. What does it add to the cookie as opposed to, say, a margarine or a Crisco?
Okay. Well, yes, I use butter. I love butter. In a cookie, butter is made up, it's an emulsion of fat and water. And it has some milk solids that help bind those two products together. And in baking, specifically a chocolate chip cookie, you cream your butter with the sugar, and that creates some lightened air inside the butter. As you put the cookie in the oven, the dough heats up, the butter melts, okay? And as the butter melts, the water is released from the dough, from the butter, and helps to leaven the dough. It creates steam, and that steam is going to help create some lightness and leavening to the cookie.
So you'll have a fluffier or a lighter cookie.
Right, correct.
So, Rose, other alternatives to butter?
Well, you can certainly use some synthetic fats out there. So people sometimes blend Crisco with butter or margarine with butter. It's certainly less expensive than a high-quality butter. And Peter really touched on a good point with the when you add butter to your cookie, the taste is great, but you also get a different texture, and the cookie tends to spread out a little bit more. So when you add a natural fat like butter, it's you have a more narrow range at which it melts, and it melts at a lower temperature than does something like Crisco. So when you add something like a synthetic fat that has more fat in it than butter does, you
maybe
get
less water?
Less water. That's that's exactly right. You get a puffier cookie. It does not spread as evenly or as much as when you use a natural fat like butter.
Well, I notice that when I make a pie crust, I used to make them with butter, but my mother-in-law makes a wonderful pie crust, and she uses the Crisco, and it's a fluffier, flakier pie crust. So yeah. Same principles at work there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And also with Crisco, it's a synthetic fat, so it's standardized. Butter isn't nearly as standardized, and if you buy different quality of butter or butter from different countries, some will have a little bit more fat and less water and vice versa. But most butters are at least 81% fat, and then the rest is milk solids and water.
Any particular type of butter that you favor, Peter Scarola?
Plugra butter is produced by Keller's Dairy right here in Pennsylvania. And it's a high-fat butter. I believe it's an 83% fat content in the butter. The flavor is better, and it just has some really good baking qualities.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's get to, we've got a lot of comments coming in and calls. So an email from Chuck who says, I struggle with getting the cookies to rise and get a solid, dense, softer cookie-like texture. Oftentimes the cookies flatten, getting hard and crunchy. What does this? Oil in butter, lack of baking soda or powder. I found adding a significant amount of old-fashioned oatmeal, which I like, seems to sustain the cookie. I also watch the heat, switch cookies between top and bottom oven racks, but still he wants to get the cookies to rise a little bit more.
Right.
So, Peter, what do you think?
So I'd suggest creaming your fat and sugar a bit longer to create that air, the air cells inside the butter. It's going to help leaven it. And also...
So when you say creaming it, you don't want to see any lumps of butter.
Correct. Okay. No lumps of butter. It'll turn from yellow to a really light pale yellow because of the incorporation of air. But also so your leaveners, they can go bad. So baking powder, if it sits on your shelf, if you don't do a lot of baking, it loses its strength. And baking soda also can kind of absorb some odors
The box
can
in
also
the fridge.
Go bad. Correct. So one test that you can do is with baking powder, you can put a little in a bowl and add some water, and it should fizz noticeably. And then you'll know that you have a good leavener.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
If it doesn't fizz, throw it out and buy a new one.
All right. Hopefully that answers your question, Chuck. We've got a comment from our producer, Trine, who says, my family is vegetarian. Can I use bananas to replace eggs?
You can try. I think that certainly bananas impart a unique flavor.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the role of eggs. So what do they do in, say, a chocolate chip cookie?
Okay. So eggs also are protein. Mm-hmm. And the eggs will help to create the structure inside the dough that's going to help hold the kind of pockets of air inside the dough. They're going to help the cookie set. They'll also... impart flavor, good flavor. You know, the egg yolk is mostly fat, which creates a nice mouthfeel and added richness to the dough, whereas your egg white is mostly water with egg white protein. So if you were to substitute the eggs, I think banana could work, but also I haven't done it personally, but some prune paste is commonly used as a both a fat substitute and an egg substitute.
Really? So there's fat in prune paste?
There is no fat, but it has a similar mouthfeel to fat when it is pureed and mixed into a dough.
Sometimes when companies or bakers try and reduce fat, they add starches. Banana does have a lot of starch. And while it doesn't bind up water the same exact way that the egg proteins do, you can get some binding and emulsification from using a starch. So I'd be curious to see how the banana worked. I don't know for sure, but it'd be a delicious cookie, I think.
Well, when Trine does this,
we'll
have
out.
Her. Yeah. Exactly. She'll have to bring some into Radio Times.
Yes.
So, and I wanted to ask, before we get off the subject of eggs, some people would rather, ditch the yolk and just use egg whites. How does this change the equation?
Again, you're going to have a cookie that is less rich. It won't have that added fat from the egg yolk and the added richness. And it may create a lighter cookie because you're adding a little bit more water to the dough.
It also changes the pH a little bit. So egg whites are one of the few foods that are naturally on the alkaline side. So they're higher in number on the pH scale. And then when acids and alkalines react to give us carbon dioxide, when we're talking about some of the chemical leaveners that we use in cookie making, so that can have a little bit of effect.
So when you change the pH again, run that by me again.
Powder and baking soda are chemical leaveners that depend on the acidity level in your dough. So egg whites, especially if they're a little bit older, they tend to be a little bit more alkaline than other food products that we consume. So pH balance is important with baking as well.
And again, if you feel you need to do this, play around in the kitchen.
Exactly.
And you might find something, a version of the cookie that you like. All right. A comment from Max who says, help, my mother made the best chocolate chip cookies. Hard, dark, small, high, with lots of chips. They look like chocolate chip cookie lumps, never flat or chewy. Mm. When watching her as a little girl, I remember her following the recipe on the back of the chocolate chip wrapper. And for years after her death, I tried to imitate her cookie with no success. I finally gave up since all recipes produce flat, chewy cookies. So Max's cookies from her childhood were hard and dark and small and high and had lots of chips. So any suggestions as to where she can get started, Peter Carolla?
Yes. So all baking in our experiment that we did at the Science Festival, the cookies that we baked with all baking powder created a really puffy, cakey cookie.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it
no baking soda,
correct.
Just baking powder.
Correct.
Okay.
Didn't have much spread. It was kind of soft and cakey. It wasn't hard. So if you were to bake it a little bit longer, you would get that crunchy, hard cookie that your mother made. And also all brown sugar in our experiment created a really tall, thick, soft cookie and also a bit cakey.
So baking powder, try baking it a little longer.
Right.
And
brown sugar.
All brown sugar.
Correct.
Okay.
I wonder, too, if maybe the oven temperature was a little bit higher as well. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that happens. So structure sets before everything else or before you expect it would spread the cookies. So that could happen, too, maybe.
Let's go to what happens in the oven. It seems to me that when I look at cookie recipes, they're either 350 or 375. What's the standard temperature? What do you use, Peter?
Well, it depends on the cookie. I tend to use a 325 temperature.
325,
but I'm baking in a convection oven.
Ah.
Okay, so the convection oven circulates the air and the heat inside the oven. So it's generally lower at home. I'm baking at 350. But then again, at home, my oven is, parts of it are probably 400 degrees and parts of it are maybe 325.
It kind of works for most of
it. It
right. Yeah. So for me, 325 in a convection oven and 350 for a conventional oven.
So, Rose, tell us a little bit about the process. You know, you put that cookie in the oven, and if you look in the glass, you can see it start to spread. What's going
on
with the cookie?
So fats are melting and spreading things out. Starches are gelatinizing, so they're starting to take on water. They're thickening what was more of a fluid type of cookie. It starts to set. The proteins and the egg whites and the egg yolks, to some extent, are also going to set and give you that structure. So it does go through that kind of thick paste. When you first drop the cookie onto the baking sheet, it gets kind of molten and luscious and liquidy because of all that melting and all of
this. And there's a caramelization.
There sure is. Browning reactions. Sure, we have caramelization, which pertains to the sugar specifically. And then we also have other types of browning that react with sugars and some of the protein from the eggs and flour and other things like that.
And this is when you have some of the flavoring start
absolutely.
To come out in the oven.
Yeah. The flavoring really happens towards the end of baking.
Oh, really?
So yeah. I mean, the initial ingredients always make a difference, of course, but all of that crispness and the brown qualities and caramel and nutty, roasty kind of flavors definitely happen towards the end of the cooking process.
Let's talk about getting the cookie out of the oven, Peter Scarola. I make gingerbread every year, and every year the first batch is not the great batch, but primarily because I overbake it. I check it, at the appointed time. It looks as if it's done. But it's really soft, and I take it out, and it hardens up too much.
Correct.
So how do you find the right balance there?
Well, your senses, the smell, the look of the cookie. It's harder to tell with the gingerbread because it's dark anyway. But with a chocolate chip cookie, you want to look for those light brown edges. You want it to smell kind of toasted and almost a little caramelized and nutty, and that, those reactions that Rose was mentioning earlier.
So visually, you should be able to eyeball it.
Visually and smell. And also, when a cookie is hot, even if it's burnt, it's soft. So if you, in the oven, it's going to be soft. When you take it out, as it cools, everything kind of sets and mellows, and then it will become really crunchy if it is overbaked.
So if you want a softer cookie, is it okay to take it out a minute or two earlier just to make sure everything, in particular the egg, is baked properly? How quickly does it take that egg to bake?
Oh, egg whites start to really coagulate around 140 degrees Fahrenheit. So they coagulate pretty readily. The yolk's a little bit higher. They're usually around 150. And that's when they start to form a gel. To have them fully baked, you'd probably go 150 Fahrenheit for the whites and 160 for the egg yolks. But that happens in the oven because we're baking at over 300 degrees.
Yeah.
And it's a small surface area, so there's not a lot of volume to the cookie. So they bake pretty well.
Right. Pretty quickly. Okay.
And there is a bit of carryover baking.
Yes.
When you do remove it from the oven, you know, your cookie tray is still hot. It's going to kind of carry over and bake your cookie a little bit longer as you take it out. And I always suggest to let the cookie rest on the tray for 2-3 minutes and then remove it and put it onto a cooling rack.
What does that do when it rests?
Well, it gives it a chance to kind of everything come together.
More flavor developing?
Not so much flavor, just the structure. You know, if you try and remove a hot cookie off of a tray, chances are it'll crumble or fall apart.
So tell the people who are impatient with the cookies.
Right.
Yeah. Hang on 5 minutes.
Right.
All right. We're almost up against the break. But just quickly, we have a tweet from Bohemian Trading. I use coconut oil and butter together in varying proportions. Good flavor becomes a little crispier the next day. Rose, you talk about coconut oil. That's popular, increasingly popular these
days.
It
is. It's very popular. It has somewhat of a healthy reputation right now. There's lots of different fatty acids that make up coconut oil, and I think it gives it's a plant-based oil, which is attractive to a lot of people. It also gives a fantastic mouthfeel that mimics very closely to what butter does as
well. So quickly, but perhaps another substitution for you could use
that
in cookies?
Sure,
I would
say so.
Try it in cookies? Okay. We are talking about the science of baking here this hour of Radio Times. Rose Trout is head of culinary arts and food science at Drexel University. Peter Scarola is pastry chef at R2L, and we're going to get to some of those telephone calls and comments after the break. More just ahead. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and we are talking about the science of baking and hopefully about how to produce a great chocolate chip cookie and other baked goods. Peter Scarola is pastry chef at R2L, and Rose Trout is head of culinary arts and food science, hospitality management at Drexel University. Promise to get to your calls and comments in just a moment, but during the break, Peter, we were talking about the value of chilling a cookie dough.
Yes.
And this is one of your secrets, you say.
It is. I like to make the dough and let it rest for ideally 24 hours in the refrigerator.
A regular chocolate chip cookie recipe.
Yes, chocolate chip cookie dough.
Okay.
What I'll do is roll it into a log and wrap it in parchment paper and plastic wrap. Chill it for 24 hours. Then you could slice off the cookies. And I like to bake them from cold. So I'll slice them, put them on a tray, and then get them right into the oven.
Well, two questions. First of all, why do you like – does that change the baking time when you do that?
It does. It does. I find they don't spread quite as much when they're cold. And it does. It adds another minute or two of baking time.
Okay. So what happens there when you're chilling a cookie dough, Rose? Why does it make the cookie better?
It makes it really tasty.
It does.
What some of the things that are going on are you're allowing the flour and the sugars to hydrate. And so one of the things that happens is some of the proteins from the egg whites and the flour start to break down a little bit, and you get a real nice browning effect and a real nice crispy, crunchy effect as well. So there's a lot to be said for resting your dough, and you do it for 24 hours.
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
That's I'm going to try that.
Actually, that's a great idea. If you're busy and you want to get cookies, can you leave them for longer than 24 hours, or do you have a deterioration?
You can refrigerate them for up to 2 days, but you can freeze them for several months. So I make cookies. I'll make a big batch, and I'll freeze the majority of it, and whenever I want cookies, I'll pull them out of the freezer, slice them, and bake them.
Love it.
Yep. Me too.
All right, we've got a tweet from Hungry Education who says, we love the mesquite chocolate chip cookie. Mesquite flour adds a totally addictive flavor to the standard recipe. Anybody thoughts? Haven't tried that one.
This is new to me as well. Mesquite as in
I suppose.
Fired, and maybe right. flavored flour? I don't know.
I've never seen it, but I'm assuming, you know, it's out there for those who like that flavor, that tang. I mean, you can do anything to a cookie.
Sure. You really can.
Right. It just depends on what you like. So,
yes.
All right. To the telephones we go, and Vanessa is live in Medford, New Jersey. Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks.
I love your show.
Thank you.
I have a question. I have two children, and they both have different food allergies. So one has celiac, so we have to do gluten-free. But then the other is anaphylaxis to egg and milk. So I heard in the show earlier, he suggested just to make biscuits. But I really would like to make gluten-free bread, but it's so hard without the egg. And I would use banana if it was a cookie, but for something that sweet like bread, I just don't know what to do.
Okay. Well, let's see if we can get some thoughts, perhaps. So I know maybe we might end up having to go back to the biscuit, Peter. But right. in the meantime, let's see if we can troubleshoot this a little bit.
Right.
No eggs, no bananas, no applesauce,
mm-hmm.
no gluten. Mm-hmm. So how do we get the bread to hold together?
I wonder if you might try some soy-based flours. Soy have some natural emulsifying agents in it. And so that I can't say for sure because I've never tried this particular exercise. But I would imagine that if you used lecithin derived from soy, that perhaps you might get a result that would be worthwhile.
Vanessa, is this something that might work with your kids?
I try to avoid soy
okay.
because of the whole estrogen controversy.
Ah.
Yeah.
But I could try it. I mean,
yeah, I mean, and also, too, in that sort of situation, I always say check with your pediatrician and see if
yes.
they give you a thumbs up.
Right.
Because if they say, okay, it might be something if, you know, you really want to get that bread baked. But otherwise, if the bread doesn't work, again, Peter Scarola, the biscuits.
Yes.
So you can make a good gluten-free biscuit. But again, she can't use eggs, bananas, applesauce, that sort
okay.
of thing. So
is dairy okay?
He's allergic to milk, too.
He's allergic to
right.
milk.
Cow's
yes.
milk.
She okay. did say that. Yep.
Right. You know what? I'm not sure. You could try to do a biscuit with a coconut milk. I use a flour. The brand is called Cup for Cup, and it's a gluten-free substitute that has, I believe, corn, rice, and tapioca starch. And I find that to be the best gluten-free substitute that I've used. There's also plenty of mixes available, I know, at Whole Foods and some organic markets. There is some gluten-free bread mixes where you just add water. I've never personally used them, but it might be worth checking out.
All right, Vanessa, thanks so much for the call to Radio Times, and good luck. Let us know how it goes.
Thank you.
All right, you're welcome. Molly comments, how important is it to use unsalted butter instead of salted butter when it's called for in a recipe? Yeah, I'm sure. Does it make a big difference, Peter?
It makes a difference in flavor. I mean, I always add salt to a cookie recipe. I think it's important to add salt for flavor. so the unsalted butter, you're going to be able to control the amount of salt you're adding to your cookie, and you'll be able to control the outcome and the flavor.
And Rose, what is the role of salt aside from flavor?
It is a flavor enhancer. It can strengthen gluten. In the right amount. So when salt is in solution, you have these charged particles that kind of hover near charged portions of gluten, and they can enhance and strengthen gluten in some ways. But too much salt has the opposite effect. And of course, too much salt in a cookie defeats the sweet purpose of
right.
the cookie. So there's that too.
Well, I love, for my chocolate chip cookies, adding some Malden salt, which is a flaked sea salt. I'll sprinkle that on top of the cookie before I bake it.
Oh, how is that
wow.
spelled?
M-A-L-D-O-N.
Okay.
So it's a very large crystal, but it's like a flaked salt.
Okay, Malden's. I'm writing this down here, Peter.
That's a great idea.
So I do add fine sea salt into the cookie dough, but mm-hmm. also some of the flakes on top, because I personally like the contrast of the salty and sweet combination.
All right. Well, hey, let's get back to your chocolate chip cookie lab experiment
okay.
because Sue has sent in an email, Susan Mount Laurel, and she says, I'm wondering if the researchers, as a part of their chocolate chip cookie experiment, as a control, had each group of bakers also bake one batch of the same recipe in order to determine the impact of the bakers themselves. So, what differences did you see if that was the case? And often when the same people cook the same recipe, they get different results. So true.
This is true.
It is true.
Well, we were limited on time. We only had a few hours to do it. The one control that we did have is we pre-measured all of the ingredients for the groups. So that was consistent across the board. And as far as the inconsistency with the groups, I mean, some we did provide scoops for them to scoop out the dough. Some of them, you know, were very generous with their scoops. Some of them were smaller. So it certainly wasn't a very, very scientific and precise lab, but it was fun.
I'll bet
and
it
there were
well,
cookies involved.
And
it
delicious.
Was, I was going to say it was an adult lab.
Right, yes.
Because instead of milk, you serve White Russians.
Yes, of course.
And there's cream in White Russians.
Right.
So I guess we're getting close to the milk experience.
Right. Like grown up milk.
Grown up milk, yeah. I don't know if anybody has this information at their fingertips. I found some online, but I'll ask you guys first. Any reason as to why milk goes so well with cookies?
It just tastes good. Well, and milk's a little bit more viscous than water or juices, and it goes really well. I would add that coffee goes really well with cookies as well.
True. It does. Well, this is from Quartz. Chocolate chip cookies have a lot of fat in them. When they hit your tongue, the emulsifiers in the milk help to smooth out the chocolate as you're eating it, and though your tongue can pick up the full body taste of the cookie eventually, the milk actually quickens this process, and it helps to mellow out the vigor of the sweet cookie flavor. So
I love it.
And that will probably work with White Russians as well.
Yes.
All right. So let's get back to the phones. Sean in Wilmington, Delaware, you are live on Radio Times. Hi, Sean.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks a lot. I like to cook stuff, but I especially like to cook things that don't require exact amounts of ingredients. And so I've always found baking to be more difficult because you have to be more exact about time and temperature and the amounts of the ingredients and proportions and things like that. So I'm wondering whether or not you can recommend any things that I could try, things that are good for someone to bake who lacks attention to detail and discipline, such as me.
We appreciate the call to Radio Time, Sean. Yes, if you're making a soup, it's a little bit of this and a little bit of that, but much less so when baking a cookie. Peter, care to take a crack at that?
Well, I would suggest a bread, because with bread you can, you know, as long as you have flour, water, salt, and yeast, those are your four ingredients to the bread. But you can generally have a feel. Once you make it a few times, you have a feel for the dough, and you'll kind of know how much flour to add, how much water to add. If it's sticky, you can add a little more flour. If it's really dense and dry, you add a little bit more water. And then you kind of have a feel of that dough. So it's a little bit less precise, I would say, than a cookie.
And Peter, what is the best way to measure flour? I've heard scoop it up with a measuring cup or spoon it into the cup. I've heard it makes a difference.
Right. It makes a difference. The best way is to weigh your flour. Use a baker's scale or kitchen scale. I use a grams in the restaurant and at home. And it's just more consistent across the board.
So how many grams go into a cup? Do you know that offhand? Because that's usually the standard.
Yeah, it depends on the ingredient. So a cup of flour is maybe 90, 95 grams. A cup of sugar is maybe 190 or 200 grams. There are charts available if you just do a Google search. Mm-hmm. You can find how much a cup of all-purpose flour weighs.
So, and it sounds as if, again, it's important to be fairly precise when it comes to baking.
It is.
Something. Okay. An email from Heidi. She says, a friend of mine used my king trumpet mushrooms, who grows mushrooms out in Ambler. Heidi says, we had sliced and dried the mushrooms in a dehydrator. Then we ground them in a spice/coffee mill. This person used the dried mushroom flour, substituting all of the flour in a standard chocolate cookie, not chip, just chocolate recipe.
Wow.
I guess what we do. Sound good?
It sounds interesting,
it sounds
for sure.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, again, worth a try if you've got time and you're playing around with different types of flowers.
Sure. So. Give you a nice earthy kind of yes. taste sure. to your cookies. Sure.
Yes, I think earthy would be the right the right word. So I love this. I love this story from PRI. There is apparently a huge patent war in the 1980s. Duncan Hines, I don't know if you heard of this, accused Keebler and Nabisco of stealing their secret for cookies that were crispy and chewy. Right. And Duncan Hines apparently got a huge settlement. But anyway, so the patents expired. And it turns out what Duncan Hines did was to make two different doughs, one for crispy and one for chewy. And then one went in the middle of the cookie, one around it. So simple science,
wow.
right,
yes,
with a fun cookie. How any thoughts as to how you might roll doughs like this in order to get that effect if you've got a crispy one and you've got a chewy? I mean, no, not often.
Oh, that's a hard one.
Maybe that's another one that you just play with in the kitchen.
Right. Okay. I think so.
Sorry about that. Right. All right, let's go to Danielle. Danielle's in Chester, and now you are on Radio Times. Hi, Danielle.
Great. Hi. I am used to using a gas oven at 325 degrees for coffee pecan cookies, and now I'm using an electric oven, and I'm using an oven thermometer and having it be at 325 degrees, and I feel like the cookies, like it's adding humidity. I'm thinking this because I'm opening the door and my glasses are steaming up using the electric oven, and they were spreading more. Am I making this up? I mean, the electric oven is definitely new to me. So can you talk about using a gas oven versus an electric oven?
I'm not sure. Do we have thank you for the call to Radio Times, Danielle. Different types of ovens. All right. So I'm not sure about the humidity factor.
Right.
And so maybe it just takes, again, a little bit of experimentation if you move from one oven to another.
Yes.
But I know you're not supposed to open the oven when
That's
you're baking
right.
a cake.
Yeah.
Less important when cookies are concerned because you yeah. want to check for doneness. But what happens with a cake, Rose?
Well, especially in a home oven, it's not a lot of area that we're talking about. So when you open the oven, you may lower the temperature immediately by 40 or 50 degrees. That makes a big difference. Also, when you close your oven door, this is pretty simple. It might slam and juggle things up a little bit. And so you might get a little bit of a collapsed cake there because the structure isn't set. And then it takes some energy to get the oven back up to the temperature. So consistent heat, I think, is always the best deal mm-hmm. for cakes and cookies to some extent, too. Although sometimes right. people will increase the heat for different types of applications.
Right. Yeah,
I would suggest maybe try inserting a butter knife or a spoon in the door to keep it cracked open a little
oh,
bit,
really?
And that'll remove some humidity if you're having issues with moisture inside the oven.
Okay.
But I think trial and error going from gas to electric would be the best bet.
Yeah, it can be a big adjustment.
Yeah.
Okay.
I would also suggest baking in the center, the middle rack of the oven. One tray at a time. I think it's the most consistent heat. Okay, right in the top of the oven, oftentimes you have hot spots. Depending on where the heat source is from. On the bottom, if you have heat coming from the bottom, your cookie is going to brown a mm-hmm. bit too much on the bottom. So right in the middle of the oven, middle rack, one rack at a time.
So it takes a little longer.
But I think you'll get the most consistent results.
Yes, that's true. You do have a really big differential sometimes between the top and the bottom of the oven. My husband's a physicist, and we did an experiment at home where we did measure the temperature, and it was between 50 and 80 degrees different from the bottom shelf rack to the top rack.
That's big.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. It can. So center shelf is the best.
All right. Well, listen, we're just about out of time, but we talked about Rose's chocolate chip cookies. Peter, I'm not going to ask for any trade secrets, but we'd love to hear some thoughts as to what you do to make the perfect chocolate chip cookie.
Okay.
What do you use?
So the best thing I do is brown sugar and white sugar, combination of the two. Let the dough rest. Again, salt, fine sea salt inside the dough, and a few flakes of the Malden salt on top of the dough, and a high-quality chocolate chip.
Any recommendations? Any names? Now we're going too far.
Okay. Valrhona chocolate.
Okay. Peter Scrolla, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Peter's pastry chef at R2L, and Rosemary Trout, great to have you with us as well.
Thank you so much.
Rosemary is head of culinary arts and food science at Drexel University. And as always, check out our Facebook page, whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today, Kevin Griffin, producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, Elizabeth Fiedler, Renee Nuri, and Susan Greenbaum. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan.